reach the
Welcome to the show. My name's Dave, and this is another very special episode of Fistful of Podcasts. Why is it special, you ask? Well, because of the same reason it always is. I've got a paleontologist who is here to talk to me about dinosaurs. He's a specialist that I can't wait to dive into. So please help me in welcoming paleontologist Andrew Farkey.
Hey, how's it going?
Andy, I should say. Marty, I'm off to a great start. Andy, we first met at Beer and Bones here in Arizona, much like I met Matt. And number one, super cool to hang out with you. I got to sort of exploit the rules of speed data scientist because I jumped in before the timer had started. But when I found out you were a ceratopsian specialist, and after the interview with Matt went so well, I was like, damn it, Andy is coming on this show.
Uh-huh, happy to be here.
So, Andy, you're out in California.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What got you into paleontology? Stock boring answer, or question, rather.
Well, it's I'll give the stock boring response that I give everyone, which is I discovered paleontology and dinosaurs when I was about 4 years old. I grew up in South Dakota, and in eastern South Dakota, but out in western South Dakota, overlooking the town of Rapid City, are these giant concrete dinosaurs. Which actually were a WPA project back in the 1930s. And, you know, they've been there, of course, you know, they're, by today's standards, they're horribly outdated.
Right.
But they're incredibly iconic. You know, they've always been painted the same ugly shade of green and white. And, you know, like every kid in the state or in, you know, like a 15-state area has been there at some point. And so when I was 4 years old, we were on a family vacation out to that area. You know, my parents took us kids there. And I saw this, and that was basically the end of it. And it's been all downhill since.
See, I always identify with these stories the most, except for I was like either too lazy or too inept at like seeing it through. So anyone who goes the distance, I'm fascinated with.
I think I was basically just too dumb to realize, you know, like it was a really bad idea to try to be a paleontologist. But here I am today.
I feel like that's everybody's feeling, though. Like, as we're kids, I feel like every kid is into dinosaurs at one point or another, and it's just a very special few that make it through to adulthood with that desire.
Yeah, those of us that are lucky, those of us that have had the opportunities to really pursue it. Yeah, and, you know, some people I know, you know, I have friends that have come at it a little later in the game, too. But I think, you know, kind of the stereotypical response is, yeah, I found him, you know, like when I was 2 months old and, you know, whatever, I was breastfed by a triceratops or something like that.
So now that I've gotten a few of these interviews out of my belt, I now feel comfortable asking, what is like the dumbest question you get asked on a daily basis, or like the most like mundane or pedantic? Like, what's the one question you wish you would never get anymore?
Oh, I think, you know, for me, well, I mean, there's a lot of those kind of questions, but I think number one is the question, is this a dinosaur egg? You know, because the answer is never yes. And
who is bringing you dinosaur eggs?
So what typically happens, and this is, you know, I don't want to really make fun of people because, you know, this is like well-meaning. People are interested. They're curious in what they find around them. Mm-hmm. And so, like, say you're walking out in the desert, you find this really cool round thing. And of course, the immediate assumption is it must be a dinosaur egg.
Right.
So it's like, well, I'll take it to a museum. And, you know, have it identified by a paleontologist and, you know, and then see what happens. And I always try, you know, because our museum and many museums, you know, will identify stuff that people bring in kind of as a public service.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, about most of the time people are like, you know, they're disappointed, obviously, but, you know, I can always spin it in some way like, oh, this is so cool. You know, this is from a volcano that erupted, or, you know, this is from, you know, this kind of rock. And there's a lot of cool things about, you know, any rock.
Mm-hmm.
Any rock has its cool side. But then you have like that 5% of people that no matter what I say, they are convinced that I'm dead wrong. Right. So, and I've had this where it's like, you know, sorry, you know, this isn't a dinosaur egg, but, you know, it's a cool rock that represents the geology of this area. And you're like, no, you know, you're wrong. Don't you see it? You know, don't you see like the dinosaur embryo that's trying to make its way out? And I'm like, no. And then it becomes like this battle of wits, you know, of someone who doesn't really have any paleontological experience thinking that I'm just trying to, I don't know what earthly reason I would have for like not wanting to accept it as a dinosaur egg. Because dinosaur eggs are cool. And you know, like if someone found a dinosaur egg in the Mojave Desert, like that's really cool. Anyhow, that's why I dread that question, because you always get like that one person that they just convinced that no matter what I say, like I'm just inept, or you know, I don't believe hard enough that it's a dinosaur egg.
Yeah, sometimes it needs is belief. At that point, you just be like, yeah, it's totally a dinosaur. You have a great day.
Yeah, but then if I say that, then they want to know how much it's worth, and then we go down, and if I want to buy it, and we go down this whole road.
Oh, no, it's just a rock. Just kidding. Ha, yeah, psych. Yeah, yeah. Get out of here. I never expected that to be one of the questions that you'd get.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, there are paleo sites around Arizona that I frequent, and I've pulled out a number of what I think are teeth, but I'm not willing to stake my reputation, limited reputation on it yet.
Yeah,
I didn't know you could just waltz into a museum and be like, hey, what are these?
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, many museums will do that. And it's, you know, it's something that's kind of fun to do. I like the interaction with people. It's, you know, it's neat. But of course, there's always that subset of someone that brings in, you know, whatever, you know, crazy thing that they're not willing to accept is not nearly as cool as they want it to be.
Yeah, that's always a bummer. As a matter of fact, I can think of an exact instance when this happened, because a few weeks ago when I was talking to Matt, he said sauropods didn't use gastroliths, and my brain immediately shot out to my collection.
Yeah.
And the gastrolith that I bought, and I was really bummed out.
Yeah, you know, that's the case. And here's the other, like, you know, dirty secret. Is, you know, most of the stuff that's sold as fossil, you know, coprolite, fossil poop, it's usually sold as coprolite. You know, they say this is usually stuff from up in Washington State. There's a particular area where you find these things that look, you know, kind of for all intents and purposes like a turd. But, you know, all the careful geological work has strongly suggested that all it is just like mud that got squeezed through something and made a really cool shape that looks kind of poop-like or looks kind of intestinal, but it's not. And then, you know, then to top it off, a couple of years ago, there was actually an auction house that sold one of these things, you know, that was billed as like the world's longest coprolite, because it was like 6 feet or 10 feet long or something like that.
What?
And, you know, I looked at it, I'm like, well, you know, actually this is not, but, you know, I'm glad someone paid $10,000 for it, you know.
Holy hell.
Yeah.
Usually, like, because I'm no stranger to the rock and mineral shows around the state, and everybody has trilobites, ammonites, and coprolite, but usually they're not from dinosaurs, they're from turtles, or they're labeled as from turtles.
Or they're labeled, they're often labeled as from turtles, and if they're the stuff from Washington State, you know, they're really cool, and it's still a little bit of a geological mystery as to how they're formed, but there's no evidence at all, you know, other than kind of general squishiness and a little pinch off at the end, you know, that it actually is a coprolite. Which is a bummer, because I had one of those, you know, growing up as a kid, too. I think someone had bought it for me.
Man.
But in a way, it's kind of even cooler. Like, how cool is it that there's a geological process that generates something that looks like fish or turtle poo?
It's not often you stumble across, like, a turd-shaped rock, but it's still kind of a bummer.
Yeah. Well, but then I thought, like, why did, in the case of this, you know, 5 foot long or however long it was, example that was sold, like, how on earth do you get like a perfect 5 foot long string of turds?
Yeah.
Like, I was trying to like think through the process. Like, what is it? A turtle that like had the worst case of constipation and it was just kind of walking along, laying this out, you know, laying track behind it. I just don't know. So it doesn't make any sense.
I would really love to send you my Instagram and you could like double check all the stuff that I have.
Oh yeah. 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 Well, that's like my job as a paleontologist is, you know, crapping on everyone's dreams and hopes.
Man, that's one unintended consequence of these interviews is having all of my boyhood dreams crushed under the cruel boot heel of some, you know, ivory tower, you know, intellectual like yourself.
Yeah, I'm in the basement.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, so you know, I've seen a lot of stuff about how you know, the fossil market is saturated with all these fakes, but I don't want to talk about any of that. What I want to talk about is your specialty, and that being ceratopsians.
Mm-hmm.
So many questions, but the first one I have that's really itching my brain is, so I'm sure you've seen the tooth found on the eastern United States of a ceratopsian.
Oh, yes. It was. I was the senior author on it.
So what's the deal? Do we have a species? Like, I've read some of the papers, but for those of us, rather the listeners who aren't following all these paleontologists on Facebook and Twitter like I am, do we have a species? What's going on, and what's the significance behind that tooth?
Okay, so I'm gonna have to back up a little bit and give you some, like, you know, paleogeography here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just, you know, maybe you know some of this, but I'll give it for the benefit of those listening that may not.
Right.
So if you rewind, like, you know, 90 million years ago or so, 95 million years ago, at this point, North America was split into an eastern and a western half by a big seaway that ran from what's today the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to what's the Arctic Ocean today. Mm-hmm. So you basically had this giant, you know, shallow marine body that divided the continent into two halves. And, you know, once you have that water body, that's a barrier between dinosaurs moving back and forth. And so it was after that point that the horned dinosaurs like Triceratops evolved. And so, you know, on the eastern and western halves of the continent, things were kind of doing their own thing. You know, you had like your western animals, the tyrannosaurids and that kind of stuff. And then you had your eastern animals, which included some sort of archaic plant eaters and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, you know, this separation. And we know, obviously, you know, because it's not separated today, that the seaway had to drain or at least, you know, sort of start to dry up somewhere towards the very end of the age of dinosaurs, around 66-67 million years ago. But there was a debate, like, you know, how early did that happen? Did, you know, was there a reconnection between east and west before the big extinction 66 million years ago when that, you know, that asteroid hit? Or is it something that happened afterwards? So that's a scientific question. And it's mm-hmm. Creates a hypothesis that's testable. So, you know, if you have the two halves split, you expect to find different kinds of animals on each because, you know, the animals can't walk back and forth. But then, you know, obviously what, you know, or maybe not so obviously what you'd expect is once those two land masses are rejoined, you know, then you can walk from point A to point B, and then you'll maybe start to get similar animals on each side of it. And so for that reason, you know, for years and years and years, basically up to just last year, we didn't have any idea that something like a Triceratops would have been in eastern North America, because they were very, very common, of course, in western North America. There's Triceratops, there's Torosaurus, there's all these things walking around. But there had never been any evidence of that in eastern North America. And we always thought was, well, because the land bridge or whatever hadn't formed, these horned dinosaurs were still walking around. So then, and this is a great example where like one little discovery can really kind of clarify things really, really quickly. Last summer, George Phillips, who's a paleontologist in Mississippi and is a, you know, a regular fossil collector for his museum where he works, was out and he found this dinosaur tooth in a stream bed. He knew it was dinosaur. His expertise is in invertebrate fossils, you know, but sometimes you get dinosaurs as bycatch on this stuff. And, you know, he knew it was a dinosaur, but he wasn't quite sure what it was. So he posted it on Facebook. A mutual friend of ours, you know, reposted it and, you know, said, well, you know, it looks like it might be a horned dinosaur, which when I saw that, like, I immediately got really, really, really excited because here you have, you know, what's very obviously a classic Triceratops-like tooth from Mississippi, so that eastern half of North America.
Really?
Yeah. So I got in contact with George immediately, said, hey, you know, I'm really interested in, you know, working on this. This is scientifically a really important fossil. And, you know, then we got to work on, you know, figuring out the significance, identifying it as precisely as we could and all that. So just, you know, kind of to you know, cut to the chase here, you know, what he had found was a single tooth, which will never get you down to species, you know, because with dinosaurs, typically, you know, the teeth are very similar across closely related species.
Mm-hmm.
But it was enough to show that it was a member of the group of dinosaurs called ceratopsids. So that's the group that includes Triceratops and Styracosaurus and those kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, the kind of the advanced horned dinosaurs, the ones that have all the spikes on their frill and the horns on their faces.
Okay.
And what's so distinct about the tooth that lets us do that, identify it to that level, is that it had a split root. So, you know, on most animal teeth or most like a crocodile tooth or something, it's just a single root, kind of like on a human incisor or something. But in the more advanced condition in animals like Triceratops, the way the teeth fit together, that the root is actually split in two. And so that's really distinctive. And if you find a tooth that has a split root like that, you know, hey, this is something very, very closely related to Triceratops. So that's, you know, what we're able to tell from that. You know, it's just one little specimen. We don't know the species, but it gives us a whole bunch of information, you know, specifically saying that somehow or another, this animal, either it or one of its ancestors, had wandered over from Western North America into Eastern North America. And the way that had to have happened would have been through some sort of direct land connection.
So when this tooth was found, I imagine there was some sort of follow-up investigation. Like, was there a dig done to try and find more pieces, or are we just sort of waiting around for something to be unearthed?
Yeah, so we're waiting for something else to come up. So the, you know, because it's found in a stream bed, you know, you can't really dig directly. And just by the nature of the way fossils in those rocks are preserved, it's typically isolated bits and pieces. You know, I don't think anyone is really holding out hope that there's going to be a complete skull out there. You know, yeah. I think this is probably just about it, you know, at least from this particular animal, but you never know. So George is going to try and get out there, you know, when the water level is right, and, you know, he and some of his colleagues, and see if they can find more.
So when I first saw that, the bloat my Twitter feed, I was like, oh my God, this is incredible, number one. Number two, I saw that you released, like, the model to 3D print it at home.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
That was cool, too. Like, I couldn't believe that all of this stuff was happening, and, like, it seems like this year alone, so much stuff has just been blowing up, and before I'm fully done digesting the latest discovery, there's a new one that's, you know, blowing up and, like, you know, moving through the paleontological community like wildfire.
Yeah, there's always something new. It keeps it fun.
So I can't hold this off any longer. The T-Rex scales.
Oh, yes.
So what new and or interesting evidence has come out to show that Tyrannosaurus is losing, or not, maybe not losing, but has less feathers than some people thought? Mm-hmm. What's going on with this thing?
What it is it's a really great survey that was done by a couple different paleontologists. I wasn't connected with it directly, but, you know, I know a lot of the people involved. And what they did is basically documented all the different skin impressions and skin fossils that are known for various tyrannosaurs, including, of course, the iconic T-Rex, because everyone goes ape over T-Rex for some reason. I mean, it is cool. It's not it's no Triceratops, but, you know, I'll accept that there's some cool features.
Yeah.
So at any rate, what they did is they had an exceptional specimen of T-Rex that's from Montana originally, and it's at the Houston Museum of Nature and Science. And what it shows is they have a couple different patches of body exterior impressions from across the body. You know, there's some from the neck, I think some from the tail, some from, like, the underside of the belly, you know, some leg impressions.
Mm-hmm.
And so what those, you know, what they show basically, or what, you know, they seem to show, is that these were areas that were kind of scaly, you know, so they didn't have, there's no obvious feathers on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, looking at all of the evidence and looking at skin impressions from other sort of like T-Rex cousins, and then some sort of the, you know, the stuff that's more like distant T-Rex ancestor, what the authors suggested was that, you know, yes, the early kind of tyrannosauroid thing, so like, you know, the great, 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 great grandpa and grandma,
right,
tyrannosaur, you know, they had feathers or feather-like structures, basically like fuzz. And then later on, as, you know, tyrannosaurs got big, or, you know, some other factors, they lost some sort of fuzzy body covering, at least on parts of the body. So that what they're saying is, you know, for the parts of the body that they sampled, it doesn't look like there's, you know, any sort of feather or fuzz or anything like that. But, you know, of course, the authors were very careful also to qualify, like, well, we don't know, you know, maybe they did still have it on, so, you know, the back of the neck, or, you know, parts of the, you know, over the top of the animal, because those are parts that aren't preserved,
right,
in these particular specimens. But of course, you know, you mention anything with T-Rex, you mention anything with feathers, you know, the dinosaur fanboy and fangirl community just kind of loses its mind. And, you know, when this came out, I guess it was yesterday, you know, I was just relishing in the salty, salty tears of, you know, sorrow from, you know, people on the scaly T-Rex side and people on the feathered T-Rex side and everyone in between, you know, just like kind of freaking out over something that's like, meh, to me at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause intellectually, I think we can all realize that whether it had feathers or scales or a combination of both, it's all just sort of a philosophical debate because they've been dead for millions of years.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, there's nobody that doubts that kind of the ancestral tyrannosaurs had a lot of body covering. I mean, I've seen these fossils myself. They look kind of stupid, actually. You know, it's like, yeah. You know, one giant, you know, floofy poodle doggy, you know, type thing. It just, you know, like if it was 25 foot long. So, you know, I think it's more of a, you know, like because it's T-Rex, you know, we as humans are ridiculously obsessed with, you know, every aspect of it, which, you know, it's a cool animal. I'll grant that.
Right.
But
yeah.
the other thing is that, you know, many people, and myself included, sometimes like we're just not capable of thinking rationally or objectively when it comes to Tyrannosaurus. So I think that's the other phenomenon that's going here. Because, I mean, some of the stuff on my Facebook page, it was like, well, you know, how do we know that the skin that they found was from underside the neck? Maybe there was some sort of burial process where skin from the underside of the foot got, you know, moved up the side of the body. And I was like,
I don't think so.
I mean, yes, there's lots of things that need to be considered in terms of preservation and that, because preservation will do weird things to, you know, just look at all these, you know, like stories about, you know, chupacabra or whatever washed up on a beach. And what it turns out, it's a raccoon that rotted and it lost all of its fur. You're like, yeah, maybe it was like a furry tyrannosaur that lost all of its, you know, covering after death, and that's all we're seeing here. And, you know, who knows? That's possible. But, you know, I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over it, I guess.
Yeah, until there's enough of the skin impressions and whatnot, like, if we ever find a T-Rex in the caliber of, like, let's say, Leonardo the Mummy,
yeah,
then maybe we can put this to rest. But I'm still enjoying seeing each side fight for its ideal.
Yeah,
And being in the scaly camp myself, I being one of those fanboys, I am still holding out for, if it did have feathers, maybe it was just a little, maybe it was a cool mohawk, like Stripe the Gremlin, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm totally cool with that too. And I'm, you know, kind of where I fall in it is like, I think my personal bias, it was probably a lot like an elephant, like we see in mammals today, where there's fur on patches and, you know, maybe in some populations they had a little more than others. But yeah, you know, just, you know, there's no good evidence to show, you know, that it really had, you know, like this giant, you know, furball that some folks really, really, really want to be the case.
And that's interesting that you bring up elephants, because that's immediately where my mind went as well. Yeah. Because when you look at a baby elephant, you know, they can have a full head of hair, for God's sake.
Yeah.
And then once they get up to stomping size, you know, they're pretty much naked.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, other than a few patches here and there. So, yeah, you know, and, you know, that might be what happened with tyrannosaurs. You know, we just don't know right now. And because there's really no way to test it, you know, with the fossils we have at the moment, like, yeah, it's like, yeah, whatever.
All right. So keeping in the same vein of feathers, I've not read anything about this. I've not seen anything about this, but the question still stands. Did ceratopsians have either quills or proto feathers or something like that? Cause I think, Am I crazy and remembering this wrong, but they are ornithischian?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
The evidence right now is really good that at least some ornithischians had fuzzy or floofy body coverings. There's some phenomenal fossils from Siberia that basically show these totally fuzzed out little ornithischians. And there's other fossils from China that show, you know, earlier ornithischians that had a lot of fuzz. And we even have cetacosaurs, which are sort of early offshoots on the ceratopsian branch, that have quills, at least over their tail, in at least one specimen. That said, that same specimen also has scales across a good chunk of the body. And if we look at any of the skin impressions for animals like Triceratops or Centrosaurus or Chasmosaurus, the ones where we have really good skin impressions, in some cases over a very large area of the body, you know, it's scaly or it's, you know, sort of a bumpy skin. There's really no evidence in those animals, those later ones, of any sort of fancy covering, at least in the animals that we've seen so far.
Yeah, I hadn't seen, because that seems like it would be something to break Twitter wide open for paleontologists. If someone was like, oh, we've got a fuzzy Triceratops, then I feel like that would be something.
But
so I just kind of, because I've seen, you know, different paleo art interpretations of, like, maybe they had sort of those proto feathers or those thick sort of quills on the back or the tail. but for the most part, you just sort of see them in the public eye. Hasn't really changed much over the last 100 years, really.
Yeah, and that's fine by me.
Well, yeah, me too. Like, yeah. The Triceratops is the, I feel like it's either like a close first and second sort of relationship with T-Rex and Triceratops for like children's first dinosaur exposure.
Yeah, yep.
And you just sort of went with the horns instead of the teeth, which is totally cool because the Ceratopsians have a huge, huge lineage.
Yeah, and they've got way more variety. I mean, if you like just looking at, you know, kind of a distance or a silhouette outline, every Tyrannosaur looks the same. You know, every stinking Tyrannosaur, it's a carbon copy. I mean, yeah, like, you know, one of them has an ectopterygoid bone that's slightly more hooked, or one of them has like an extra tooth and whatever jawbone. But, you know, you see one Tyrannosaur, you've seen them all. Ceratopsians, though, like, you know, they've got this huge variety of frills, of horns, of spikes. You know, these things were just kind of going wild with their skulls. You know, it's like, you know, there's no contest which one is more interesting.
Oh, no doubt. So I don't know. I know there's only probably like 13 or 14 members of the Tyrannosaur family that we have going back to like the mid-Jurassic. Yeah. How many different species of Ceratopsians are known, or ballpark?
I mean, I guess it's what, Wednesday or Thursday when we're recording this, so yeah. I have no idea. Yeah, you know, it's a, yeah, you know, like, you know, there might have been 5 more found yesterday, another 10 to be announced tomorrow. I mean, honestly, I've lost track because there's dozens of these things, just so many new fossils that are pouring out of the ground and making it into the literature all the time. So it's a really cool time to be a Ceratopsian paleontologist.
Yeah, every day or so, someone I follow will post, you know, one of those big Simpson style posters of all the Ceratopsians that they could fit on. And, you know, it's mind boggling. They are, you know, whereas beetles today are ubiquitous and can come in any shape and size, like Ceratopsians were the beetles of their time period in their weight class.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. They're everywhere. They're common. There's lots of great fossils of them. But here's kind of the weird thing in terms of what has been published on the anatomy of these horned dinosaurs. We still know far more about T-Rex, which is, you know, generally a more rare dinosaur than something like Triceratops. You know, there's still so much work to be done on these things.
How was that possible with so many specimens and so many artist recreations and all the bones we're pulling up? How is it that Ceratopsians have sort of been left backstage, essentially?
Fewer people working on them. I mean, I guess that's less true than it was, you know, today than it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I was getting started. But, you know, for every Tyrannosaurus skeleton that we have, there's at least, you know, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but there's like 5 researchers focused on it. And, you know, with Ceratopsians, it might be more like a 1-to-1, you know, a little more of an even fight.
Right. Well, and look at it this way. When you see a documentary about the African plains, they'll be like, oh, there's a bunch of buffalo, but now let's spend the next 45 minutes on the lions.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And in fact, my taking that into a little digression, my wife and I were in South Africa last summer. I had a conference over there, and so we worked it into a little bit of a vacation, and we went up to Kruger National Park, which is just phenomenal. I mean, it's so cool because you basically, like, if you have your own vehicle or you rent a vehicle, you can drive anywhere you want on the roads there. And so it's like, you know, it's basically like you're driving around in Jurassic Park, kind of. It's like, oh, I got to stop for an elephant or whatever. But our big annoyance was, like, anytime there was a lion in the area, you'd have this massive roadblock of like 50 or, you know, 50 cars that wanted to get like this little glimpse of this poor, stupid lion that was just like sleeping under a tree and just wanted to be left alone. But if it was like a herd of antelope, which have far more interesting behavior to watch, like, we wouldn't see any cars, you know, within about 10 miles of us. So I had just a grand time, you know, watching these things, the antelope and all these herbivores, and of course the birds, which my wife was into watching, just far more interesting to watch because predators, you know, like, there's not many of them and they just kind of sit around all day.
Humans are nothing if they are not attracted to novelty. Like, the point of being alive is to find all of the weird stuff that you can. So if, especially since carnivores are in the minority And, you know, their lives are obviously somewhat more interesting because they're, you know, they have to kill and eat to survive.
Yeah. Yeah.
More interesting than watching a gazelle like eat some grass. And you're like, whoa, exciting.
Yeah. But we were there like right at the start of the rut. So, you know, we actually got to see horn use in action. You know, so these things using their horns against each other, wow. Which for me as a ceratopsian person, it was awesome because I think about that stuff all the time. And so the chance to actually see that behavior in the wild and figure out like, oh, you know, this is what animals with horns are actually doing. And I can actually, you know, see it with my own two eyes, you know, 100 foot out my car window.
That's one of the things that people, I don't think, you know, the layperson outside of the paleontological circles thinks is like dinosaurs were so bizarre and so large and so strange. And they just like completely don't fit into what you consider as an animal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you don't think like, oh, they must have just acted like other animals. Mm-hmm. You think, oh, what did they do? They had like these horns. They were huge. All these frills. They must have been doing some crazy things. But animals are still just animals.
Mm-hmm. And they probably like, you know, just like any animal, a lot of dinosaurs, you could watch them for 5 minutes and then just be bored as snot because like, yeah, well, it's still standing there, still chewing.
So the ceratopsians mostly come from North America. Is that correct?
North America and Asia. The group probably originated in Asia.
Okay. In the U.S., we see huge frills, huge horns. And the only thing that usually makes it out of Asia to the layman is Protoceratops.
Yeah, Protoceratops and Psittacosaurus. And yeah, they're not nearly as cool, at least in appearance.
So are there working hypotheses as to why the North American branch got these elaborate ornaments, whereas in Asia, not so much?
No, not really. I mean, it just, you know, I think it's an accident of evolution. But we do have a good idea of why, you know, you don't see many over there. And that's, again, kind of an accident of just, you know, what land masses were connected when. Because, you know, these big ceratopsids, kind of the ones with the ultimate skulls, they evolved in Western North America. And Western North America was separated from Asia, kind of the end of the Mesozoic. And, you know, it wasn't until the very end when there was another, you know, presumed land bridge between the two of them that things, you know, made it over into Asia again.
Interesting. Yeah, that's because when you hear about these things now, most dinosaurs that anyone can identify are like the Triceratops, the Stegosaur, the T-Rex, you know, the in and out of vogue Brontosaur.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, at least for me, when I'm thinking of Asian dinosaurs, I'm thinking of the small feathered things that are coming out in scads. I'm thinking of like the Velociraptor that hit in a big way. And of course, I'm sure they had, you know, hadrosaurs and stuff like that. But it just doesn't seem to have the same, I don't know what I'm trying to get at here. It's very specialized in that they have a ton of those little feathered dinosaurs like Microraptor and stuff like that. So do you think that's due to the preservation of that locale, like the different mediums they were being trapped in? And maybe we had that same sort of variety over here, or we just on two different arcs?
Well, a lot of it, I think, is, you know, preservation bias, or at least a collection bias. You know, we know that there's lots of little dinosaurs, you know, things very closely related to Velociraptor and that hanging out in North America. They just don't get found quite as often.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't, you know, we don't have the special localities like, you know, some of the ones in China where you get really awesome preservation of a whole bunch of small bodied things with fine details preserved on them.
It's kind of a blessing and a curse because you do have areas where, you know, all that fine sandstone stuff really preserves the everything pretty well. I mean, we got feathers and you know, I've even seen where they're starting to discern the different colors of the feathers of the dinosaurs they're pulling out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here it seems like unless you're big, you aren't going to, or big to an extent, you aren't going to make it past a certain point.
No, that's, you actually have a lot of really big dinosaurs hanging out in Asia at that time, too. I think they just don't get the publicity that you do. I mean, there's something, you know, there's a couple things very, very closely related to Tyrannosaurus. In fact, some people have argued that it's just another species of Tyrannosaurus. It's the Asian version.
Oh, the Tarbosaur?
Tarbosaurus, but there's also this thing called Zucheng Tyrannus.
Oh, right.
That's found, you know, from China. It's actually at the same locality where the only named ceratopsid from Asia has been found, Zucheng ceratops. So it seems to be kind of an area where you have a lot of animals that are very, very closely related to, you know, to what was living in North America at the time. So that's probably just preserving, you know, kind of the time when that land bridge was open and things could wander back and forth.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So how far back do ceratopsids stretch? I'm finding most things that made it into the Cretaceous aren't sort of popping up in the fossil record until like maybe mid-Jurassic. So how far do the ceratopsians go back?
Okay, yeah. So the oldest ceratopsian that's known, you know, so the thing in that group is going to be around, oh, what is it, like 150, 155, 160 million years old. Mm-hmm. It's this thing called Yinlong from China. And that looks like just kind of your generic little plant-eating dinosaur. You know, there's a couple features on the skull that show it's a ceratopsian and a few things in the skeleton, you know, but it's a generic plant-eating dinosaur. Mm-hmm. And then you get the things that are more discernibly, you know, ceratopsians that start, showing like a, you know, an early frill and things like that, or sort of horns on the cheeks around 120 million years ago. But you don't get true ceratopsids, you know, so the things with these big skulls and all that until, you know, the earliest inkling is, you know, maybe 80 million years ago, maybe stuff around 85 million years ago, if you really push it.
Interesting, because, you know, growing up, learning about dinosaurs, you hear the Triassic, the Jurassic, the Cretaceous. In my just basic yeoman-like researches, I'm not finding a lot of things that started in the Triassic that had the staying power to get to either of the next two periods.
Yeah, but, you know, that kind of makes sense. I mean, because if you think about the stretch of time that's involved, early dinosaurs, you know, the earliest things that are arguably dinosaurs are 235, 240 million years ago. Mm. And then, you know, from 240 million years ago, you fast forward to the end of the Mesozoic 66 million years ago. I mean, that's a huge stretch of time.
Right.
What is that? Like 100 and almost 180 million years.
Mm-hmm.
And like it'd be mind-boggling to think about any, you know, specific kind of dinosaur that would stick around relatively unchanged for that whole stretch. I mean, it's basically, you know, like our equivalent would be if we had something from the middle Jurassic that's still around and basically it's unchanged lineage today.
Right. And I guess we do have a few of those things, like tortoises haven't really gone anywhere.
Yes and no. Yes, I mean, you know, like, yeah, I mean, you have like your generic, you know, thing with a shell and a neck and head and legs, but, you know, like once you look at the details of, you know, these things that we often think of as very conservative, like turtles or sharks or alligators, there's, you know, huge differences, you know, in shape and in, you know, kind of the general feel of the body today compared to what they were 100, 150 million years ago.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess it's just my desire for something to span all three of those periods when, you know, nothing really can last. I mean, look at humans. I mean, they just found that one skull in Morocco that sort of extends human lineage back farther than we thought, but that's still nothing compared to dinosaurs.
Yeah, it's just, you know, like a little instant in time compared to that.
And, you know, no one goes to the Triassic and is thrilled by what they find. Like, we, on this show, we did a sort of expose and our favorite dinosaurs from each period, and the Triassic was a super hard place to find anything that even resembled what you're used to as a dinosaur.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you get Plateosaurus or something, but that's about it. The thing with the Triassic that I love is, you know, the dinosaurs are pretty lame, but everything else is super cool.
Yeah, the Triassic is that sort of sweet spot where you've got these hanging species that sort of made it through all the previous extinctions, the very small percentage of them anyway.
Yeah.
And it's hard to see those two mash because you either want to be in the Permian or the Cambrian where you've got giant scorpions or these early sharks or whatever, and you're like, well, that's cool. And you don't really see a lot of that meshing with people's conception of prehistory. And then, I don't know how deeply you go into the mammals, like the super fauna.
Yeah.
Have you had any exposure to them, like the Paraceratherium or like the, you know, the Siberian unicorn or any of that?
Oh, you know, I'm happy that they exist, but I haven't really done much with any of those things.
Yeah, that's the thing, man. No one cares about the superfauna. It is impossible to drum up any sort of excitement when you've got giant dinosaurs. No, you can make a rhino 40 feet tall. It'll still not turn as many heads as a single T-Rex.
Yeah, which is, you know, the rhino's probably cooler. A T-Rex has those big teeth. Come on.
Right. I kind of knew where you were going to be leaning in that that matchup. So what are we looking at as far as the largest of this clade?
For our horned dinosaurs?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, our largest one, is, you know, it's probably going to be Triceratops or something, you know, something in that group of ones that's really closely related to Triceratops. You know, animal that might top out around 25, 30 feet long total if you're counting the tail and the head and all that. Like, you know, these animals are big. You know, they're certainly, like, in their biggest form, you know, they're elephant-sized. But they're not sauropod big.
Right.
Yeah.
I had brought something up to you at the Beer and Bones, and I can't remember the name of it right now. It was the Titanoceratops, I want to say.
Yeah, haha, yes.
So is that holding on as a legitimate species, or are we looking at like, oh, it's just a big chasmosaur or whatever?
It seems, you know, I think kind of the gut feeling for most people, myself included, is it's probably just an old and giant Pentaceratops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of things in the preservation of the original fossil that are a little, you know, less clear cut than we would like. You know, it's clearly probably an old animal when it died, you know, and so, you know, it's really probably just a senile Pentaceratops. You know, maybe I'll be disproven.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's always something out there that comes along with a few remains, and then a couple years after it's been discovered and sort of described, then we see, okay, it was probably this, but then it never really jives with everybody, and so I'm interested to see where that line of discovery ends up.
Yeah, you know, I think everyone is.
So, Andy, when Matt was on, he had talked about how he had been involved in the naming of Sora, Poseidon, and Aquilops. What dinosaurs have you been associated with and actually were part of the naming process?
Mm-hmm. So actually quite a few. And I guess, let's see, let me try and remember which ones. I guess this is in the category of, you know, first world paleontologist problems.
Right.
It's like, hey, I can't remember every dinosaur that I've helped to name. That makes me officially the worst human being on the planet.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know, just, you know, mostly the things I've named have been horned dinosaurs. So I had a lot of, you know, as like, you know, junior author, a lot of great collaborations with Scott Sampson and Mark Lowen and crew on animals like Cosmoceratops and Utahceratops and Coelaceratops. So those were really fun ones to work on. So, you know, so I was part of the team on those. In terms of ones that, you know, I've been like lead author in naming, and of course in all of these cases it's with a number of other co-authors. Binops was one that we did, this horned dinosaur out of Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
I was also lead on Aquilops.
Right.
And let's see what else. Oh, and then my one like theropod, you know, everyone's got to have a theropod in their stable, Dehalucale. This Abelosaur out of Madagascar.
Really?
Yeah.
It's amazing how, because you think, I don't know, at least looking from the outside, naming a dinosaur seems like you would have to be, it would be like a working girl style, like only the top brass get to name dinosaurs and everyone else is just sort of scrambling for the crumbs. But it's really, paleontology is really a much more even field than I had at first thought.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, the problem, well, sort of the problem is anyone can name a dinosaur.
Right.
I don't butcher, you know, a famous saying, you know, like, I wouldn't trust any profession that lets me name something. but yeah, I mean, that's part of the, you know, I think part of the what makes it really cool. It's, you know, I think there is sort of a badge of... Yeah, you feel like you've kind of made it as a paleontologist when you've gotten to name something.
Oh, no doubt.
You know, I mean, that was one of my dreams as a, you know, a kid growing up. It was like, oh, someday I'll get to find or name a new dinosaur. And, you know, I count myself as pretty darn lucky being able to do that. How cool is it that, you know, I've gotten to name, you know, work on a team with people and name not one, but two, not two, but three, you know, not three, not four, yeah, but, you know, however many dinosaurs. And, you know, it's something, you know, I'm always, you know, kind of grateful for having had that opportunity.
It's never been a more exciting time. I take that back. Maybe back when the Bone Rush, that was probably a little exciting too, but I can't think of a more exciting time to be alive to be into paleontology, because the rate at which discoveries are being made and announced are just mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's not just, you know, new discoveries, but it's new ways of examining fossils. You know, like, who thought that you could cut up a piece of dinosaur bone and get an estimate of how old the animal was when it died. Or who knew that, you know, you could throw a piece of, you know, dinosaur skin under a microscope and figure out what color it was. You know, there's so many amazing things that we're learning. Like, you know, who thought you could use basically the tools that doctors use and, you know, reconstruct a dinosaur brain? Or, you know, who would have imagined that, you know, I could email a dinosaur fossil, you know, from point A to point B, and then, you know, like, you know, within minutes I could have this dinosaur skull on my computer and I could be printing out a copy.
Yeah, it's so unbelievable. And the fact that you and other paleontologists like you are making it so readily available to the public is incredible, because I can think of no other scientific discipline that not only captures the mind of the public so fully, but is so open.
We try to be. I mean, there's plenty of exceptions, and this has been one of the things, you know, I've really been fighting for during my time in the field, even, you know, starting as a student, you know, the idea that these discoveries should be open, you know, that you should be able to, like, you know, if you scan a dinosaur fossil, you know, there's really no earthly reason why you shouldn't make it available, especially right. If, you know, if you're at a public museum with public specimens, you have to strain pretty hard to make a good case, in my opinion, like why that stuff shouldn't be available.
Yeah, because if, you know, I'm not allowed to go on to like essentially public land and pull out vertebrates, I should at least be able to see the damn things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of my, you know, for me, that's one of the, I think, the strongest arguments for why we should make this available. You know, there's, you know, very good reasons why there are, for the most part, there's very good reasons why collecting of some fossils in some areas is restricted. But I think, you know, a very fair compromise, because there is such, you know, interest in it, is that we should make, you know, what fossils are in the museums as available as possible. Mm-hmm. Not everyone sees it that way, of course, right. Unfortunately. And I get very frustrated because it seems like, you know, at least a couple times a year, there's a press release from a museum about how they're digitizing these fossils. And it's going to be so wonderful because it'll mean it's, you know, the fossils can be downloaded anywhere in the world. And then absolutely nothing ever comes of it. Yeah. And this happens, you know, so often. But that's something that in my career, I've really been trying to fight, trying to lead the way by positive example. You know, with one of our the discoveries I worked on through my museum, which was a baby Parasaurolophus, we very intentionally made all of the scan data freely downloadable on the internet.
That is so cool. When I first saw that the 3D printable model of the Ceratopsian tooth from Mississippi, I thought, holy shit, yeah. Like the future is now, man. Like pretty soon.
Yeah.
All you got to do is get some LiDAR, run around a Triceratops, scale it down. You can print out the skeleton at your, like, essentially at your desktop and go over it. Like, and you don't have to any longer haul around these giant rocks and do all these measurements and stuff. If you got like the working copy right there, that opens it up to so many more people.
It should, theoretically. And there's lots of these skulls and skeletons that have been scanned, but I would say, you know, it's less than 1% of them that are actually available in any real practical way, yeah, either to scientists or to the public, which is, for me, endlessly annoying.
Yeah.
You know, to be fair, like, there's reasons sometimes why you wouldn't have particular data up there. You know, if it's still under active study, I think it's fair that, you know, for the researchers that are putting in the hard work, they should have first crack at it within a reasonable span of time.
Right.
You know, if it's fossils from other countries, like someone from the United States, I accept and, you know, wouldn't advocate that I should have the right, you know, to go over to Mongolia and without their permission, scan everything and, you know, put their country's heritage online without their permission. Like, you know, that's not something that I want. But in cases, particularly in the U.S. where we have the ability and the technology, and quite frankly, a ton of this stuff already scanned, you know, it's, I think it's really grasping at straws to put out a real good reason, you know, why it shouldn't be available. Of course, what a lot of museums will say is, oh, well, if anyone can 3D print it, you know, like, well, it's going to take away our, you know, our endless stream of cast, you know, and replica revenue, which is true to some extent. But I think that's really only applicable for a tiny fraction of fossils. I mean, you know, to be frank, most of the fossils that have been scanned are things that have absolutely no cast resale
right.
But value behind them. You know, it's like, you know, oh, look, someone scanned a crappy end of a dinosaur finger bone. Like, yeah, you know, that we just cut the museum out of $10,000 of sweet, sweet revenue. And like, that's not the case. You know, there's a few exceptional fossils, you know, like, say, a T-Rex skull, for instance. Right. You know, maybe that's, you could make an argument. But then on the flip side, you know, if we as professional scientists, and I like to think of myself as a professional scientist, argue that unrestricted commercial trade in original fossils can be ethically problematic in some cases, mm-hmm. or some people would say even in all cases.
Right.
Like, if we're going to make that argument, we really don't have a leg to stand on if we're then going to cut off, you know, one of the things that's really a pretty easy way to make fossils accessible and allow people to print their own copies. You know, if someone wants to print a copy of a dinosaur skull, and that means they're not going to go out and loot a site on public land, or it means they're not going to pay someone a ridiculously inflated price for a cobbled together and pretty horrible reconstruction with like 5% original bone, I think that's a win for science.
So like big money fossil collectors who are these no-name sort of dudes who are gathering up all these bones that like, I, you know, Morocco and like all of North Africa is kind of a great place for black market fossils.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to think that if the information was readily available to these people, I don't know if we would have had to wait so long for that fossil buyer to give up that spinosaur that he had.
Yeah.
So you keep saying, you know, if their whole purpose of this is like, we don't want to give away any of this stuff because, you know, it'll run out of, but for the most part, like for general consumers like myself or other people just sitting at home who would like to have a little replica or model or whatever, like I'm not going to go and buy a room sized printer, print out a Tarbosaur and try and sell it to the Arizona Museum.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's
although more power to you if you can.
Oh yeah. Like since I am a multimillionaire, it's, I can easily do it. I just choose not to, cause you know, for integrity, but yeah, like, I'm glad it's moving in that direction. And I feel like as soon as, and this happens in every field, as soon as the old guard sort of dies off and the more progressive minds move in, I'm sure it'll happen eventually. It's just like everything. It's slow and bureaucratic.
Yeah, yeah, you know, science advances one funeral at a time.
Yeah, pretty much. Back to the Ceratopsians. In your opinion, which is the most bizarre or exotic, like with the frills and the horns? Which species to you screams like this is something that needs attention? Because everybody knows Triceratops. What is the species that people should know about because of its out-and-out, like, bizarre form?
I mean, at the face of it, that's a really hard question.
Yeah, well.
And I say this as I'm stalling for time as I'm running through, you know, the various ones out there. But I think the one that, like, everyone should appreciate and know about is Pachyrhinosaurus.
I love that
and
one.
That is such a cool animal. So, you know, it's like you took a Triceratops, you chopped off all the horns, you put, like, this giant, I don't know even what, like, butt on its nose.
Yeah, pretty much.
And threw a couple hooks on the frill, and it's just like, it's a weird thing. It's huge. You know, the skull is like, you know, it's like Triceratops sized. It got, you know, like I said, it got rid of the horns. It has these big, like, bony pads on the face instead of that. It's just so cool looking.
And Pachyrhinosaurus is one that I often come back to when talking about ceratopsids, because not only did they make their way with essentially no horns on their face, which like sets them in a class of their own outside of maybe Protoceratops, but they have covered the most land. I don't even know how to put it, because they've been found all the way up in Alaska and all the way down into the contiguous 48. So, I mean, they were moving, man. So, and they're just overlooked because they're not Triceratops. And even though I bet if you cornered someone out in the world at large and said, hey, you know Triceratops, right? They said, of course. Say, how many other of that family do you think you could name? And I don't know if anyone can name more than two.
Yeah, if you're lucky. If you're lucky, you might get Styracosaurus, and I think it probably will end there.
Yeah, like if you asked me as a kid, I would say Triceratops, nailed it, Styracosaurus, that one's cool. Then you got Protoceratops, and then that's it, man. That's all there was.
Yeah, we're done.
But there are so many cool ones. Like Centrosaur is one of my particular favorites, simply because they kind of remind me of the Pachyrhinosaurus, but they've got the horn. And then who can turn away from the Diabloceratops after you look at that mean face?
Yeah, and it's a cool name.
Totally. Like, there are so many of these cool horned dinosaurs that nobody knows about. And so I guess, you know, you're doing the Lord's work in spreading the knowledge of these fascinating animals. Yeah, I guess since by virtue of them being herbivorous grazers, no one cares.
I guess, yeah. Well, you know, they're not T-Rex, you know. That's what it often comes down to.
That was one of the interesting things when we first spoke at the museum. I said, you know, what dinosaurs are you into? And you said ceratopsids. I was like, whoa, like no T-Rex. And you're like, not even close. And I was like, this guy is crazy.
You're not the first person to say that.
but you know, having a moment's thought and looking into it. I mean, there is so much there. I can't believe more people haven't just stumbled upon it by virtue of the variety and, frankly, bizarre nature of these animals.
Well, there's more people and certainly more paleontologists really working on them right now. You know, I like to think of myself as the hipster paleontologist. You know, I was into ceratopsians before they went mainstream.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot of great work that's happening with them now. You know, a lot of new researchers, a lot of people all over the world that are really starting to ask some cool questions and get some cool answers.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff. So now I kind of want to move into the hypothetical realm, because I'm sure you're familiar with Matt's concept of the turtle nachos.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, he had brought up something that he would rather not be in the general vicinity of these ceratopsians because of the beaks and the fact that, you know, if they're looking for, you know, maybe some, they would have no qualms about scissoring you in half is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they'll certainly take a finger off or a hand, you know, if it's triceratops.
Sure. So is there anything out there that you would like to see prove that may be a little more esoteric or a little more bizarre? Is there anything out there that you're like, oh, I hope this is something that I can prove via the fossil record?
I would love to know what a dinosaur smelled like.
Really?
Yeah. Come to think of it, I'm probably the first person in the history of mankind, you know, humankind, to say, what did a dinosaur smell like? I don't know that we'll ever know.
No.
But yeah, you know, that's probably in the category very untestable. But at the same time, like, you know, I never would have thought we'd know what color some dinosaurs were either. So
true. I mean, you can't even say that we'll never know, because those things that they were saying about that 100 years ago, we now know fully almost.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, maybe they smelled like chickens. I don't know.
I don't know. In my mind's eye, I'm looking at a herd of triceratops, and I'm thinking they probably smell like cattle.
Yeah, at least, you know, in terms of what's coming out the backside, for sure.
Right.
And that brings you to the other question. What did a triceratops fart smell like?
Hard-hitting questions.
Yeah, and I guess the internet's a big place. Maybe someone's already asked this. You know, what does farts of different animals smell like?
Yeah, I'm sure there's like an internet fart database out there somewhere. Yeah.
I mean, I know they measure the volume of them, you know, to know, you know, because it's important for, you know, climate modeling when we know how much methane is produced by cattle and that.
Right.
But I don't, you know, like what's the, and you know, people even measure the composition of them. You know, what is the case for dinosaurian type things?
Yeah, see, every time I talk to a paleontologist, they bring up something that I would have never, ever thought of.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't even thought. I think you're the creative muse here, you know, because I had never thought about this before this either, you know, so keep on doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe because when you focus on something day after day, you don't really give yourself license to let your mind wander because you're so sort of entrenched in the scientific method.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the like smell, no one, like, because everyone's like, oh, what do they look like? What do they look like? I don't think I've ever heard anyone pontificate about the smell of different dinosaurs.
Yeah, and I just don't know. It's fascinating to think about.
Well, so is there anything behaviorally that you're looking to either prove or disprove?
I mean, I've always been interested in testing the idea of, you know, what did Triceratops do with its horns? You know, was it fighting? Was it doing something else? You know, I worked with a couple colleagues, Darren Tanke and Ewan Wolf, a number of years ago. And we looked at basically, you know, are there patterns of injuries on the skulls, you know, that are consistent with fighting behavior or something like that? And we did find that to be the case. But I'd like to know kind of like, well, if they were fighting, which I think they probably were, like, how did they do it? How frequently did they do it?
Right. Yeah, there's, because I mean, you can't look at something with horns all over its face and think, oh yeah, that was just for giggles. I'm sure they were facing off.
I think so. You know, I mean, absolutely, I think so. But what were the fine points of that? You know, maybe we'll never be able to really test that for sure.
Right.
That's okay.
Now, since we're, you know, freewheeling out in the land of fancy, in your heart of hearts, do you think that at any point in let's say our lifetime, there will be any viable genetic material found?
I never want to say never, you know, because that's, yeah. I think it's highly unlikely. I think it's highly, right. highly unlikely. Just given what we know so far about DNA and its length of preservation and, you know, how it breaks down under certain conditions. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, we know we have proteins for dinosaurs, and I would not be surprised if we're going to find more proteins for dinosaurs and be able to do, you know, molecular relationships, you know, figuring out which dinosaurs are most closely related to each other based on their protein sequences. But yeah, I don't know. In terms of genetic material itself, you know, like directly, I'm skeptical.
Yeah. One of my hopes is, and this has been a subject of many a documentary where, you know, the hypothesis put forward is we would have to get, like, maybe, you know, some dinosaurs being torn apart by either one or a pack of carnivores, a hunk of their flesh flies off and, you know, lands in a puddle of tree sap, and then boom, one day we find it.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
So, like, earlier this year when the dinosaur tail was found encased in amber.
Yep.
And then later this week when that bird was found encased in amber. I mean, that is definitely a boost to the old morale.
It is. But I mean, when you think about what things are turned into when they're in amber, you know, it's not like it's just freeze dried meat or something. What it basically is, in my understanding and talking with people, is it's kind of like charcoal, basically. So, you know, stuff oxidizes over time.
Right.
Yeah.
So Andy, of all the paleontologists out there working today, who do you find is the most compelling? Like, whose work do you think is the most prescient, like moving the science forward? Like, who do you look up to and be like, whoa, I want to be like this paleontologist?
Oh, wow. I mean, other than myself?
Oh, yeah. I'm of course, you're out of the running.
Oh, wow. oh, well, that, you know, that just, you know, I don't know what to say after that. wow. I mean, I can't say there's like any one person, you know, because there's, you know, I find hero worship in science to be really dangerous.
Uh-oh.
It's, you know, it's like everyone's human. So, you know, they're going to make a mistake. They're going to do something stupid. Yeah, but there's aspects of the work that a lot of different people are doing that I think is really, really cool. Like, you know, going to the topic of proteins and that stuff, the work that Mary Schweitzer and her lab have been doing, really pushing the boundaries of what we thought we knew about fossil preservation. You know, finding these proteins, finding different biomaterials, see, like, you know, that's cool stuff. So I certainly admire, you know, the work that she and her close colleagues are doing. Sterling Nesbitt, he's another person who's done some, you know, he and, you know, his colleagues have been doing some really neat stuff in the Triassic. And there's a whole ton of people working in the Triassic, Bill Parker, Michelle Stocker and that stuff, who there's weird things that they're turning up. And I really, you know, admire those, you know, people down in the Triassic for just the crazy things. Like there was that, you probably saw that Trioptychus or whatever, that little dome-headed lizardy type thing.
Oh, right. I did see that. Yeah.
Yeah. I forget if I'm getting the name, you know, but Michelle Stocker was one of the people on that. It was like, it's like this convergent pachycephalosaur wannabe from the Triassic period. You know, insane. It's so cool. So the people, you know, people that are working in the Triassic, I think, you know, that's really where it's at.
The Triassic has nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing in there that you're like going to come across and be like, oh, well, there goes the Triassic's, you know, claim to fame. Because as of right now, it's only like notable, you know, contribution is this is where the dinosaurs started. Mm-hmm. No one can name any dinosaurs from there.
Yeah.
But we know that it's definitely a pivotal point in the Earth's history.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's like a hard, it's after the hard reboot of life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's, I think, you know, something that's very cool. But, you know, then I think about, you know, like other colleagues I really admire, you know, beyond like their work, you know, people that have really shown, you know, just, you know, really pushed the field forward in cool ways. One of my favorites is John Hutchinson, who's he's a American-born paleontologist now based in the UK, who's done a bunch of the stuff with dinosaur locomotion, He was, one of the people involved early on looking at, how T-Rex moved. Of course, I got to go back to T-Rex. I still like that work. Mm-hmm. He's been doing some cool stuff looking at, chickens and how they're put together. And he, working with a lot of his students and colleagues, has been doing that. But beyond the amazing science that he's doing, he's a heck of a nice guy. And I really admire what he's done to push for openness in his science. So making sure that all of his data is open. But the thing that he has done, and not a lot of other people have effectively, is really talk openly about the hard parts of science. Health problems, mistakes he made early in his career, things that he regrets, things that he's happy about. And I think the way that he's talked so openly about that, beyond the fact that he does really great science, and his, he and his lab, everyone in his lab does really great science. I think he's moving the field forward by just talking about the human side of science.
There's definitely a market for scientists who make science available to the common man. Mm-hmm. Because even for me, and I read a lot on dinosaurs, when something comes up in my feed and I read one of these papers that doesn't happen to be a sort of a digested version that's being printed in an online publication, yep, or a newspaper or whatever, they are dense, man.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's a problem.
Like, I was just reading that study. They went and took the Megalosaurus jawbone and hit it with a CT scan. Yep. And now they're all the rethinking about, seeing how the teeth grow in and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, wow, I get this. But I could see someone else with just an average, off the street sort of mentality being like, I don't understand what's going on here.
Yeah, the hard thing to do is communicating science and communicating it well. Communicating why it's important. I think kind of a stereotype that science is this very esoteric thing. And I think scientists sometimes play into that. But there's so many good angles to every study that's out there. If you just communicate it effectively, you can really make it sound cool.
That leads me to an interesting question. What about paleontology do you think is the most important aspect?
Oh.
Essentially, why do you do what you do? When you're learning and passing out this information, what are you hoping to achieve aside from just like, well, that's cool?
Yeah. So at the very base of it, we're time travelers. That's what we do, is we're professional time travelers. We go back in time, using the tools that we have, and try and reconstruct what the long-lost world was like. What was Earth like 100 million years ago, or even 5 million years ago?
Right.
So just in the sheer kind of human characteristic of exploring, I think that's so important about what we do. And of course, I could talk about all the pragmatic end of things, like, we can use paleontology to understand modern day climate change, or we need to know, this or that because, it'll help find this or solve that social problem or whatever. But I think, that can be where we often go a little bit off the rails too, is, I think it's a bit of to try and have to find practical solution or a practical reason for everything. And I think that's, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing that we do as a field. What other field of science, other than perhaps astronomy, can basically say like time traveling is, it's our business.
I think that's what gets the public excited too, is this concept of deep time. Like, the human brain is not set up to grasp deep time. No. So if you say this thing was alive 5 million years ago and this thing was alive 65 million years ago, I don't think the average person would see that as a huge gap, simply because once you get over 100 of something, it's just like, okay, I get it. Yeah, it's a million. I understand it conceptually, but there's no time to let that sink in.
Yeah, that's exactly the problem. Yeah.
Which is a bummer, because deep time is an interesting concept, but I don't know if the public at large will ever really fully grasp, because the person walking, I've been alive for 30 some odd years. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that times a million.
Yeah. And I can't even do that. It's hard as a paleontologist. That's, I think, the most, it's challenging, maybe less challenging for us as paleontologists to some extent, but it's still, it's a huge challenge. It's hard. It's way, like you say, it's way outside the spectrum of what we know for our own lifetimes.
Totally. So is there anything that you found in studying Triceratops and its ilk that you did not expect to find? Were there any discoveries where you were like, whoa, I didn't expect them to do X, Y, or Z?
I think the biggest surprise for me as a researcher has been just how many darned species there are of these things. When I was growing up, there had been sort of this, decades long hiatus in the discovery or the description of new species of horned dinosaurs. you know, there was, I think, one species named in the 1950s, you know, Pachyrhinosaurus, and, you know, things kind of close to that. And then there wasn't another new thing named until 1986, which was Avaceratops. And then, you know, it was another 10, 15 years before the next new horned dinosaur had been named. And these were all kind of like incremental, you know, additions to, you know, what our you know, knowledge of these things was. Mm-hmm. And so I had kind of thought, especially, you know, when I was like in high school, back around that time, it's like, oh, we know just about everything that there is to know about the horned dinosaurs in North America. You know, we're not going to find another Triceratops-like thing. We're not going to find another Centrosaurus, you know, close cousin. And then, of course, thankfully, I was so wrong about that, because, you know, just over the last 15 years, I think we've practically doubled or tripled the number of species in some of these specific groups of horned dinosaurs. And in some cases, even in areas that had been very well explored, you know, the dinosaur beds of Alberta, like who would have thought we'd have another 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 new species of horned dinosaurs coming out of there. We all thought, you know, I thought at least that, well, we know everything there is to know. Anything we find is going to be a variation on a theme. And there's just some amazing stuff coming out of there.
Yeah, Canada and Alberta specifically has been a metaphorical hotbed for fossils.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I remember when I was a kid watching the first documentary about dinosaurs and seeing a young Philip Curie talking about the Centrosaur beds and all this other stuff. And you know, you look at it now and people are finding that Nodosaur that was a strike out of nowhere, like lightning in a bottle. There's just so much coming out of there that as a kid and probably as a layman, you don't think of Canada as having these huge variety of species.
Yeah.
But it makes sense because, I mean, the dinosaurs were everywhere. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think the, you know, the expansion of dinosaur discoveries in other parts of North America, Utah, for instance, as some of these areas have been more explored, like Grand Staircase, you know, then, you know, which is where I do some of my field work in other areas, or, you know, the new discoveries that are being made in places like Mexico, or, you know, even the, you know, the stuff coming out of China nowadays, it's just phenomenal. It's jaw dropping. And it's been, you know, I think a kind of an exciting time to be, not just kind of, it is an exciting time to be alive as a dinosaur paleontologist and as a ceratopsian paleontologist, because, you know, you take what we thought we knew 20 years ago and we thought, hey, we're pretty comfortable in how all these things fit together evolutionarily. We have a good understanding on like the species and that. And then you just throw that all out the window and it's like, well, you think that one was weird. Check out this.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with a buddy of mine about this very interview, and, you know, I couldn't help but gush about how thrilling this year has been for discoveries. And even just as an outsider, like as a layman, like there's so much stuff coming so fast. I can't imagine what it feels like to be professionally involved in all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exciting. It is so exciting. It's, you know, and it, you know, I guess it's job security because, you know, with every new dinosaur we find, you know, it's not just naming the species. There's all the other studies that open up as possibilities, you know, looking at growth rates, looking at behavior, looking at patterns of injury, looking at ecology, looking at all this stuff, you know, the way the skulls and the bodies functioned. You know, it's not just simply naming a species. Every time we find something new or even a new specimen of a previously known species, you know, just like, wow, the world of research questions just got exponentially bigger yet again.
Yeah. You know, and speaking of, you know, the research and how it can go wrong sometimes, there have been plenty of mistakes when, like, mounting dinosaurs. Like, for instance, in 1905, that first Triceratops that they mounted, it was, you know, several individuals and some bones from a duckbill dinosaur. The T-Rex's stance, the Iguanodon stance. Like, when you look back at all the things that we got wrong, what is your favorite mistake? Because I definitely have one, but I'm interested to see which one yours is.
What would be my favorite mistake?
It can even go all the way back to like the Crystal Palace and the Iguanodon with the horn on the nose instead of the thumb.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think my favorite, I don't know if this is really a mistake, but a very outdated mount was the Hadrosaurus mount that was done, you know, way back in, I guess it was, what, the 1860s, 1870s, originally on display at the Academy of Natural Sciences, you know, when they first had the bones of this animal and were trying to put it together. And they ended up with something that was, in some ways, kind of kangaroo-like, kind of lizard-like, you know, because they knew a lot about the skeleton, so it was a big improvement over the Crystal Palace Iguanodon. There were still things like the skull shape and that was just so far off in a way that's, you know, really alien to what we know today.
It was hard for me, like, as a child, seeing the T-Rex, which is my favorite mistake, by the way, like, having it standing straight up and walking kind of like a doofus.
Yeah, yep.
To it being, like, essentially kind of like a modern bird or an ostrich or a chicken, where its body is held parallel to the ground.
Yeah.
So nowadays, when you look at a dinosaur and you put it all together, what information do you base its stance and locomotion off of? And why do you think they didn't have that, you know, way back in the day?
Well, a lot of it is personal preference. You know, do you want to show it, you know, running at full tilt? Do you want to show it just kind of chilling?
Mm.
Today, though, like, we have the advantage of having complete skeletons from tip to tail of so many of these kinds of dinosaurs. If you look at, you know, what they had at the time of the Crystal Palace, like, yeah, they had a chunk of the skeleton, but they had nothing that was a completely articulated, all laid out skeleton, like, you know, was discovered a couple decades later. So I think that's the big difference, is we just have the benefit of so many more fossils and so many more complete fossils. You know, like, I think we know the body plan of a T-Rex or a Triceratops or a Apatosaurus, like, we know it pretty darn well. And, you know, I think, you know, if you were to, you know, take a paleontologist from 1865 and transport him to today and showed him the scientific literature and some of these discoveries, like, you know, they'd come to exactly the same reconstruction as, you know, I would as a contemporary paleontologist. You know, it's, you know, it's just, we have a lot more information than our earlier colleagues did.
Yeah, and I think, in my opinion anyway, today more attention is paid to the bones in situ instead of, you know, blasting them out with dynamite and putting together at the museum.
Yeah, that's certainly the case.
Because every dig I see, there'll be a field notebook where everything will be drawn out to a T, like, here's where this bone was, here's where that bone was. And so you're getting a picture of it before it's even out of the ground. I don't even think they had that concept back
then.
Not
everyone, although, you know, to be fair, like, a lot of there were some incredible exceptions. You know, when the iguanodons were found in Belgium in that coal mine.
Yeah.
You know, they have wonderful maps of how all that stuff was laid out. You know, great sketches and even photographs in some cases of the fossils as they were discovered. But, you know, I think that is, you know, to some extent, kind of the exception. You know, a lot of the earlier paleontologists didn't take field notes that were great by today's standards. Yeah. So I think, you know, I think it's just, you know, some of it is change in training, change in, you know, thoughts on what is important data to collect. You know, it's just so many factors on the social side of things.
Yeah, because when you think about, like, American bone collecting, and you know, you can think back to, like, George Cuvier and all those guys, those old naturalists before paleontologists was even a thing. You know, they were making their best guesses, and I think they were a little ahead of the Americans, because when Cope and Marsh were blowing mountains apart, I can't find any literature that they spent much time in the field. They were paying these guys, essentially, like, these laborers, to pull these bones out and throw them on a train. And I can't imagine how much data was lost by those dudes just blowing up, you know, mountain after mountain, sabotaging the other guys' sites. Like, I feel like America was definitely behind the eight ball as far as, like, locomotion and stuff, because it was more about the fame than it was about the science.
Yeah. And, you know, we still have that element today. You know, there's still that kind of the seduction of, you know, being on TV or having your name on, you know, this or that. You know, I think we all, you know, are tempted by it. Certainly. I mean, that's why I'm a dinosaur paleontologist, right?
Right.
you know, I wouldn't get the same level of, you know, media exposure. You know, we wouldn't be talking, you know, likely if I was studying fossil mammal teeth or something like that.
Yeah, or if you were, like, an invertebrate paleontologist. But, yeah. Oh, it's nice to meet you. See you later.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think there's that factor, too. You know, things have changed, but they haven't necessarily changed that much in some levels.
Right. Now, I saw an interesting program about the Triceratops and how these scientists were trying to figure out how it walked based on the casts of the bones.
Yeah.
The two prevailing hypotheses were legs out like a lizard or legs under the body. Now, has that been sort of put to bed by now?
I don't know if it's been definitively put to bed, but I think people have kind of lost interest in worrying about it. if that makes sense. You know, it used to be there was, like, a new paper every year, or a couple new papers a year on the topic. That said, I think the consensus has kind of gone towards, you know, they, at least on the front, you know, hind limbs were definitely fully upright. front limbs were probably, you know, not sprawling, but they weren't holding them directly underneath their body like you'd see on an elephant. You know, they kind of had this bent elbow posture is how it's usually shown. And I think, you know, that kind of seems to be where everyone has ended up at.
There are still, even the stuff that people take as fact, there are still detractors to every hypothesis and every theory out there. So it's hard to even say with any confidence, you know, this is what they did, this is what they didn't do, aside from like the bare minimum, like, oh, it ate meat, it ate plants. Pretty much that's all we know for sure.
If we even know that for sure. In
true.
Some
yeah.
You know, we have plenty of meat eating theropods now and all that. But, you know, quite, you know, for me, like that bit of mystery is okay. You know, that's what makes it interesting. Like early in my career and my exploration of dinosaurs, I was maybe a little less happy with the fact that there's going to be a lot of things we don't know and that we'll never know. And I think, you know, kind of as I've matured as a scientist, I'm okay with that. It's what makes the field interesting. And, you know, that's really why I or anyone likes dinosaurs. They're mysterious. They're fun. There's things we don't know about them. There's things where, you know, all we have is our imagination. And, you know, perhaps that takes us beyond the bounds of testable science. But, you know, it's fun to think about, well, what was the color patterns on a Triceratops face? What did it sound like? What did it smell like? You know, what were its farts like?
People are constantly asking about those farts.
I know. I'm just on a one track here, single track. But it's, you know, like it's that mystery. You know, that's why I love dinosaurs.
Yeah, I think that is the end all and be all. Is people love things that they'll never know. Like I, you know, wherever this lands, I'm also a fan of, like, not a fan necessarily, but a follower of like the Jack the Ripper case, because that's, you know, one of our biggest mysteries. And I think if any of these things were solved, they would get, you know, immediate, maybe it's 15 minutes of fame. Like let's say tomorrow.
Yeah.
You could flesh out a Triceratops. You knew its color. You knew how it walked, how it acted, the sounds it made, how it used its horns. It would be big, big, big news. But then it would, I feel like it would immediately fall off because people would be like, well, now we know everything about it.
Yeah.
So who cares?
Yeah, it's just like an animal in the zoo, right?
Yeah, like people stopped getting into boats and sailing for America once, you know, it was discovered. Once you know where and what something is, it really cools as far as popular culture is concerned.
Yeah, at least on the pop culture side. As, you know, as a scientist, you know, there's always something new to find.
Right. And that's the thing, even if we had a living animal, like, because there are living animals, we don't know much about it all. Like we don't know why they do things, what their structures on their body are for, and in some cases. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you're really behind a 65 million year old eight ball.
Yeah. Well, but this is kind of the thing where things get a little ironic is, you know, this is a true fact. Like we actually know more about the anatomy of T-Rex than we do about the anatomy of the lizard that's sitting outside in your yard right now or out on the sidewalk.
True.
Like you're going to find more publications, more descriptions, more figures, more photographs of T-Rex bones than you are of, you know, in my area in Southern California, it's fence lizards,
right?
Western fence lizards. Like good luck trying to find a comprehensive, you know, description of the skeleton of one of those things. It doesn't exist. Or if it does, you know, it's woefully incomplete. But you're going to find like a description of every single bump on every single bone of a T-Rex.
Well,
and, you know, we know more about the skeleton of a T-Rex than we know about the skeletons of most living animals today.
Yeah, but I bet if we could get a fence lizard to hop up to about 30 or 40 feet long, I bet we'd get them in droves.
Yes, but, you know, you look at the large things today. True. Elephants, you know, there's been plenty of stuff on elephant anatomy, but not nearly as much or not nearly in as much detail as we have for a T-Rex, which is something that I find wonderfully amazing.
I'm struck by something, and I wonder, I'm going to run this up your flagpole and see how it sits.
Yeah.
I think humans are more drawn to the other. With elephants and living animals, people can really identify with mammals, and I think that sort of turns them off because you can find a lot more kids who are interested in bugs than are interested in sheep. If something is crazy weird, even if it's, you know, big or small, whatever, you're going to be drawn to that strangeness. So, like, I can go to the Phoenix Zoo today and find a kid, like, bored to tears in the alligator enclosure when you've got these giant monsters swimming around, because, you know, you can, they're easily accessible.
Yeah.
But with a T-Rex, I think the T-Rex has a sort of a perfect publicity storm, because there's very few specimens, and scarcity brings up their market value like crazy.
Yeah. It's that mystery. It's that mystery.
Yeah. What you need to do is go around and destroy as many ceratopsian skeletons as you can, making the ones you have so precious that people will automatically be enthralled.
Yeah, well, you know, you've just given the Tyrannosaur activists lots of ideas, so thank you very much.
Are there activists for Tyrannosaurs?
I don't know, but as a paranoid ceratopsian worker, there must be.
It's true. So do you think that maybe people who study herbivorous animals sort of take on that sort of wariness of the carnivores sort of coming and usurping your place on the food chain?
Yeah, I'm always looking out, you know, like for the Tyrannosaur Liberation Front.
So not only has that grudge lasted for 65 million years, it has transcended species.
It has. It's remarkable. You know, they just won't give up.
Yeah, and oh boy, I've got so much stuff that I want to like go over as far as like dinosaurs only from most part eating juvenile animals and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Because in the most paleo art, you'll see a T-Rex facing off with a full grown Triceratops.
But, yeah, because that's way more metal, right?
Yeah, I mean, like if you pick up Bob Bakker's book and you see that T-Rex bearing down on that full-grown Styracosaurus, you think, oh yeah, that was probably happening all the time. But like, what are the chances of that actually having gone on?
Yeah, virtually none.
Yeah.
But you know, that doesn't make as good of art.
True. You're like, nobody wants to see a heartless T-Rex plunging its teeth into a baby Triceratops.
But other than Tyrannosaur fans, you know, it's those Tyrannosaur activists.
Are they that heartless?
They gotta be.
Yeah.
So anyone who doesn't love ceratopsians the way I do has to be heartless.
Yeah, I think we should continue our wild speculations on these Tyrannosaur extremists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh man. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, Andy. So I got a couple rapid fire questions here.
Okay. Fire away.
Being an American paleontologist, I'm sure you've landed on either you're a cope guy or a marsh guy.
Oh, marsh. He named Triceratops.
I should have known.
Even if he was not nearly as nice of a person as Cope was, you know, and Cope actually got, you know, apparently got in a fist fight over something, which is awesome.
So since you are a marsh guy, I imagine you're not going to have your brain saved so it can be measured against one of your rivals.
Funny you mention that. I actually once volunteered for a medical experiment for that very reason.
Who was the other person?
Well, it actually wasn't a rival. It's a good friend. So we had when I was back in grad school, they were looking for volunteers for an MRI study where they were doing some brain work. And I'm like, hey, I'll volunteer for this on the condition that you'll give me the disc with the data for my brain. Because I had a bet with the fossil preparator at Stony Brook at that time, who's a very good friend, over which of us had the larger brain. Sadly, I lost on that one.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know. I never should have, you know, I should have just lived with the myth that, you know, I had the larger brain.
Right.
But yeah, so that I actually have gone so far as to at least, you know, volunteer for medical experimentation so that I can figure out if my brain is bigger than someone else's.
Well, at least you didn't offer a deathbed ultimatum to someone who was like, no way.
Yeah, so, That's true.
I guess it's better to have definitive answers than to be left wanting.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
So if you haven't already, I've got to ask this. Would you ever go to Philadelphia to see Cope's brain?
I think it would be cool. Yeah, why not?
That's definitely on my list before I die. I've got to get a look at that guy's brain.
Yeah. I mean, I visited Marsh's grave when I was in New Haven, Connecticut. So, you know, I got to do the similar Cope thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, for no other reason than to like show your superiority that you've conquered time as far as that's concerned.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Okay. So last one, when you were a kid, did you look up to any of the big names in paleontology? Because when I was a kid, I was all about Bakker. I was all about Horner.
No, I absolutely did. I mean, because, you know, these were people that were in the news all the time. And I think, you know, one of the more surreal parts of coming into my own as a professional paleontologist is I know pretty much all these people now on a first name basis, which is, I kind of want to be able to go back in time, you know, like 30 years to my younger self, you know, like when I'm, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 years old and be like, hey, you know, like you're going to get to know all these people.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, I mean, you know, like I said earlier, you know, everyone is human, you know, so you start as you get to know people better, you know, you see their quirks and their flaws and all that. But at the same time, like, you know, I'm incredibly thankful and grateful for the opportunities I've had to really, you know, run with the big people and, you know, get to be a professional.
Yeah, I understand that, like, you know, we're all human and everything, but put a 13-year-old me in the same room as Bob Bakker and, like, you'd have to call the paramedics.
Yeah.
Because I would be, like, dunzo.
No, totally, totally. And but, you know, the cool thing is, you know, as I've kind of grown up, it's like, yeah, they're all people.
Yeah.
And, hey, I get to hang out with them at the conferences and talk with them and bounce ideas with them as a colleague.
That's so cool. Like, I can't imagine, because every time I try and talk to somebody about dinosaurs, they're like, okay, yeah, that's interesting. And I can't imagine the feeling of getting into a room where everybody was all on the same page and you could just go over data, throw wild theories around, and just sort of pontificate on these amazing creatures.
Yeah, it's a real privilege, you know, being a paleontologist.
Super jealous.
Me too sometimes.
All right, Andy, thank you so much for appearing on this show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's been super great. I think I've definitely learned a lot about, you know, a really underrated family.
Mm-hmm.
Is it family? Was it clade? Whatever. Yeah, huge amount of dinosaurs. Whatever you want to call it. There's so much to learn out there. And I think that most people do get caught up in you know, your big meat eaters and your big sauropods. But you got to remember, man, ceratopsians, they were everywhere and they were crazy.
Well, and as some of my most diehard friends who are big Tyrannosaur people say, you know, Tyrannosaurus Rex had to eat something.
Yeah, I mean, everybody kicks down. And when you look when you look low enough, there are the Triceratopses.
Yeah.
So, Andy, what's in the future for you? Anything we should be looking for? Is there anything you're working on that our audience, my audience, should be aware of?
Oh, well, you know, there's always something happening. But my big project right now is working on a new pterosaur from Utah, something that's probably a small cousin of Quetzalcoatlus, you know, one of the flying reptiles
right.
From the end of the age of dinosaurs. We got a partial skeleton that's from an animal that lived around 75, 76 million years ago. So I'm working on that with a couple of colleagues right now. So hopefully in the next year or two, we'll have something to say about that.
That is very cool to hear. And, you know, I will be waiting in bated breath, but I won't be starved for choice because it's coming out fast and furious.
That's true.
So if somebody wanted to follow you on Twitter so they can get all the links to everything else, and I'll put links to everything that you're involved in the show notes, but let's say someone's listening and they want to jump onto Twitter and grab you real fast, how do they get you?
Easiest way is just my Twitter handle, Andy Farke, at Andy Farke, AndyFarke, and that'll get you all of the fun dinosaur news and open access and open science musings and, you know, a little bit of homebrewing beer stuff, you know, kind of whatever's on my mind at the moment, you can see on the Twitter feed.
Yeah, and I gotta say, there's always something cool coming down in your Twitter feed, so I cannot recommend that enough, and that'll lead you to everywhere else, but I'll be sure to make sure that people know where to get good science.
Fantastic, thank you.
All right, Andy, so thank you once again. And guys, thanks for listening to another bonus episode where I get to talk to a paleontologist and you have to listen. See you next time.
For this. Podcasts Radio.